I was determined to be part of a bipartisan approach to address the court decision in Dobbs. As you look to that opinion that was handed down, it pretty much laid out to the Congress that if you're going to address this, it needs to be legislated. And so the only way that you're going to get legislation like this passed is if it's bipartisan. It's just apparent. The Democrats tried to advance what they viewed as a potential response. This was even before Dobbs came down, and it was in my view far in excess of codifying Roe versus Wade, and it was not a solution that I felt reflected the vast views of most people in this country. I think if you look at polling, it is clear that in this country, most Americans would say that they accept a woman's right to choose, but recognize that that is not without limitation. So you ask about the inertia, and that's fair. Right now, I might suggest to you that there's probably a little bit of politics that is going on. I think you see Democrats that are saying, we're the ones that want to support women, and Republicans don't. And Republicans are looking at the Women's Health Protection Act and saying Democrats want to allow for unlimited abortion at any time with no exceptions whatsoever. And the truth is that it's somewhere in the middle there, as it usually is. But I don't think that right now we will see resolve on this, probably until we get on the other side of these campaigns in this mid-election cycle. I think that that's unfortunate, because as I'm talking to women around the state, they're very, very unnerved by what they have seen as a consequence of the Dobbs decision. They don't know what happens next, but they're anxious, and I would like to give some certainty and some finality, and that's why I'm working on a bipartisan effort to do just that.
And sticking with that for just a moment, you said when the leaked draft opinion came out that it rocked your confidence with the court, and that it was unexpected based on your conversations with the nominees. Mm-hmm. And just sort of, this is a two-part question. I'm curious whether that experience changes how you evaluate future court nominees and what you think should be done to restore your confidence and public confidence in the court.
Well, I made that statement, and it really did. I think the word I used was rattle my confidence. And it was based on the conversations that I had had directly with these justices as we'd gone through the process, where I have an opportunity in the quiet of my office to ask as many questions as I possibly can. And I really felt like I should be able to rely on their truthful answers to me. Now, they weren't under oath. Maybe that's what I need. I'm not suggesting that, because I can't put them under oath in my office, but it has caused me to look at our process as how we confirm Supreme Court nominees for lifetime appointments. If the hearings have become nothing more than just either a little bit of showboating that goes on, or really answers that are so nuanced that they don't really give any foreshadowing of the individual and their perspective, if they really don't have much meaning anymore, how are we to allow for a process for confirmation of this very select group of individuals that are in this extraordinary position of power? And so you ask a fair question, and I don't yet have the specific answer. There's some who've said, well, we just need to expand the court. Well, if the process for putting these individuals on the bench is still the same, then that doesn't tell me how that really changes the equation here. So I don't think that's your answer. Some have suggested maybe it's not a lifetime appointment. That would be an interesting conversation. There is no judicial code of ethics that the Supreme Court has, as other bars have. Some have suggested that that you know we need to look at that. I think, quite honestly, I think that that's something that the courts need to do internally. But these are important. We need to be able to believe in the integrity of our courts,